Come on in. Good morning. All right, tonight we're we're on our last class. It is the twilight of our class. We are lesson 13. And I told you on Wednesday, or asked you on Wednesday, to look at these chapters, chapter 38, which we've not covered before. We've looked at chapter 37 a couple of times, and we may make reference there. And then these three chapters that precede the story we looked at in our last class. We focused on Joseph and his reuniting with his brothers, his revelation of his identity, receiving his brothers, forgiving his brothers for all that they had done to him, and all the great blessings that came for Jacob and his family as a result of Joseph's position. And but today we want to back up and look at some of the details of what led up to that, and particularly through the viewpoint of which character? This is your assignment to think about Judah. All right, so that's who we want to focus on today. What can we learn from his life as it's recorded for us in Genesis? So, when we go back to chapter 37, we don't see, well, there are a couple of things we see Judah doing specifically, but most of what we're going to attribute to Judah is via his participation with his brothers, right? It's the 11 brothers versus Joseph, right? What problems did we see going on in the family between these brothers in that chapter?
Jealousy.
Envy. Let's make a list here. Is Judah a participant in that? Is he jealous of his brothers? Is he showing envy? Envy and jealousy. They're all in it together. And in fact, it goes so far as to say what often goes with envy and jealousy. Okay, there's one step in between.
Hatred.
Hatred, yes. They hated him. Okay, so the hatred they had toward Joseph, and that was only accentuated because of the way Jacob showed favoritism to him and gave him the tunic of many colors and so forth. The dreams that he had and the interpretation he would give to the dreams, it said that when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So he had this deepening hatred. And of course, when the opportunity came that they were out in the fields and Joseph was coming to them from a distance, they thought, here's our chance, what can we do to him? That James said.
I'm going to add a little story here. That
sure.
When Joseph revealed himself, mm-hmm. he not only said, God used what you did, mm-hmm. he said, God did it.
Yes, exactly.
And I've tried to figure out, how did God do it?
Right.
And those dreams may very well have been the way God used the nature of mm-hmm. those brothers.
Right.
Just as he used Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. He hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
I don't think he did it directly.
Right.
But really it was his goodness mm-hmm. that hardened the heart of Pharaoh. And it was probably those dreams that even upset his father.
Yeah, that's right.
that God used to accomplish his purpose.
Right.
Causing them to do that envy and jealousy, he knew they would be that they would respond with. But that didn't mean that he caused the sin.
Right.
The sin was in their heart already.
Right.
Or they would not have responded if they did to the dream.
He's intervening in a way, but it's the reaction of the character of the people.
But God caused it.
But God was the trigger for it. You can even back up a little bit. Why was Joseph the favorite son?
He's the first son of Rachel.
First son of Rachel, son of his old age. Why was Jacob the son of his old age? What had God done?
Closed
the womb of Rachel, okay? The wife that he loved so much, you know, that he wanted, that he originally worked 7 years for and thought he was getting that first wedding night. God seemed to have intervened, right, to prevent Rachel from having that child, which produced the chart we had up there, all the other brothers that were there. And then when Joseph was born, he became the favorite because of all the weight. And God's hand seems to have been in that. Again, God isn't necessarily forcing anyone to do that, but that created this sort of special relationship that he had, which only accentuated, again, these feelings among the brothers. And perhaps Joseph can see, as he said, God did this. It wasn't you doing this. It wasn't these things came about because this was God's plan and God brought this about. So very good thought. See, this is why you're here.
That's a footnote, maybe a toe note.
What's that?
That's a footnote.
Oh, a toe note, okay.
Well, you see, it makes it, I mean, if someone knows your character, mm-hmm. knows your character, yeah. know how you respond to certain stimuli,
yeah.
they can set certain things in front of you,
right.
and you'll respond in the
right.
way mm-hmm. that's their will, but you're
right.
doing it. They're not
you're
forcing you to do anything.
You're responsible for your actions, yeah. right? Yeah. But here's a scenario. Yeah. What are you going
what
to
are
do?
What are you
going
to do?
Right. And that's the theme of our lesson today. There's a scenario, a number of scenarios that are being created and presented for people. What are you going to do? And that's a big part of what happens in the story we're looking at. But thinking again, so the hatred, the envy, the jealousy, when the opportunity came, what were they going to do to their brother? They were going to kill him. Now, did they actually commit murder against him?
In their hearts, in their hearts.
In their hearts, they effectively did, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus, if you have hatred in your heart toward your brother, if you're angry with your brother, it's murder in your heart, right? It's tantamount to the same thing. And had Reuben perhaps not intervened, that might have been the case, right? He persuaded them, you know, to just put him in the pit, and right? He was intending to come back and rescue him, right? But while Reuben was away, what did the brothers decide to do instead of just letting him die?
Make some money for him.
Let's make some money. And whose idea was that?
Judah.
Verse 26. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Israelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, he is our flesh." So, what attitude do you see in that idea? Let's profit from the misfortune of our brother.
Maybe he believes murder is wrong.
Okay, maybe there's some hint and that he's, because he makes that argument, right? He, you know,
yeah,
let's not lay our hands on him. He's our own flesh and blood. So he has some scruples here, that, but maybe we'll let the Israelites, you know, and we can profit from that, right? So not purest of motives, but of all the sins we've been looking at in Genesis that remind you of anything, which profit off this, how would we categorize that? Maybe. We had a lesson on materialism, right? Is maybe to some extent Judas thinking, oh, hey, we can make money off this situation here. It may not be an honorable thing that they're doing, but let's profit. So he sees the value of material possessions to some extent. And that was
good news to Joseph, but no more credit to Judah.
Right, right. That certainly helped with the plan, but we really can't look at Judah and credit him with much in the way of good intentions. And then, of course, with his brothers, what do they do to their father after they sell Joseph off?
They deceive him,
right? They let him conclude.
They lied to him without telling a lie.
They lied without saying anything, right? They brought the tunic all torn to shreds, and with the blood of the lamb they put on it, and or the animal that they killed, and let him conclude that he must have been eaten, destroyed by an animal, and lived that way for years, right? Mm-hmm. I think we have mentioned some of the story before about how that ongoing grief of their father may have gnawed at them and created that conscious appeal even years later. So deception, materialism, hatred, envy, jealousy, murder. Not a very good resume here of things going on in Judah's life. But then we get to chapter 38. We're not going to go through it in great detail, but if you've read that story, what sorts of activities see Judah doing here, right? First he goes off and starts hanging out with who?
A Canaanite.
Okay, he leaves his brothers, visited him. He has his buddy here, a certain Adulamite. His name was Hira. He and Hira seem to be good buds. And they do a bunch of things together here. So, is he friends with the Lord or friends with the world? We had a verse about that, right? Don't change it. We talk about worldliness. Because he seems to be inclined to align himself with people of disrepute, people of lower character. But while he's there with his buddy, what does he do? You could say he starts a family.
Yeah.
That'd be one way to phrase it. You could say he married a young lady and started the family, but what does it really say? Saw this woman. He saw a daughter and he went into her, right? He took her and went into her and see she conceived and bore him a son. Now, I don't know if they ever made it legal. Right?
Mine says married.
Does the earth say? Okay, my New Mexico, it yeah. doesn't say. It says he took her and went into her. Maybe there's a taken or, you know.
New King James does say married.
At some point, they, you know, they were a family. But if you read the whole story, is this a story of marital fidelity and sexual purity? And no. In fact, later, what do we see Judah doing? After his wife dies, and he goes back to his buddy, Hira the Adullamite, and he sees this temple prostitute, he thinks, there by the side of the road, and what does he decide to do?
The same way how he met his wife.
The same way he met his wife. I'm going to go into her, except that here there's payment involved, right? So I'll just put sexual immorality in there. Okay. How does that compare to his brother Joseph when he was in a similar situation of being pressured to being tempted to engage in that kind of immorality? Joseph resisted. Joseph fled from it. He wanted nothing to do with it. Here, it just seems to permeate Judah's character, right? Along the way, this is the story, you know, with this woman, this Canaanite woman, he has three sons, right? Mm-hmm. And then the oldest gets married to Tamar. So this is Judah's daughter-in-law. But that first son was apparently no good. Surprise, surprise, right? And the way it's worded here, right, it says the Lord took his life because he did evil in the sight of the Lord. We don't have any details what the evil was or how his life was ended. But the Lord's hand was behind it. And what does Judah propose that his second son do with Tamar, the wife, the widow now, of his firstborn? Go in and do what for her?
Go into her and have a child.
Yeah, have a child by her. Right. Okay. Now, this is, I think, the first time we read about this practice of the brother, of the childless one who's passed on, going in and raising up, producing children with the widow. Later, that practice would be incorporated into the law. This was a duty, right, that in order to preserve the family line, right? But did Onan, the second son, was he willing to do that?
Yes and no.
Yes and no. I mean, he kind of went through the motions here, but he knew what? Any children that came out of that relationship would not be his, it belonged to someone else. And
the blessings and all the other things.
The inheritance, everything that came with it. So he refused to cooperate in that regard. And is that selfishness or selflessness? Selfishness. Surprise, surprise. You read about that in Genesis among Judah's family. So what did the Lord do to him then?
Kill him
just like the first son. So now Judah's two out of three of his boys now have been taken by the Lord. He's got one left who's fairly younger. And what does he say to Tamar? To whom he owes this obligation. Right. Just wait a while until my youngest is old enough, and then he'll take care of it. Okay. Well, time passes, right? So, first of all, considerable time passes, right? So much so that Judah's own wife here dies, and this is where you see the story. He's going to see his buddy, and he goes into the temple prostitute. But of course, who's the temple prostitute actually?
Tamar.
Okay, so she's figured out, and she explains this, right? Verse 14. For she saw that Shelah, the third son, had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. So, what a commitment Judah made to her, you know, that my third son will take care of this. He's not following through with that commitment. Maybe because the concern he had initially probably was more that Emerald was the third one too.
He thinks in some kind of way she's associated with their dad.
Yeah.
She's so bad news.
Maybe she's the common factor in this equation. I don't know. But he's reluctant so he's just gonna cut her loose. You know, if we're up to Judah, he's just gonna ignore her and she's going to die childless, and you know, that would be a bad outcome for her. So she dresses up like the temple prostitute, right? And goes in and Judah, of course, the issue of payment comes up, right? And Judah makes a promise that he'll give her this kid, an animal, right? But she asks for a pledge. What's a pledge?
Signet?
Yeah, something. Like when you leave your driver's license at the place, and, you know, it's while you rent the bowling shoes or whatever, you know, whatever it is, and it's like, I'll give this back to you, and, you know, so Judah's leaving something of value, personally identifiable to him as a commitment that he's going to come back. He cannot go without those things. He's going to commit to come back to pay her when the time comes. And he sends his buddy to go and do that, right? And his buddy just says, you know, there's no prostitutes here at all. No one knows of anyone that fits this description. And they're baffled and confused by this. And Judah says, well, we did the right thing. You know, I sent the payment. And I tried to be honest with her, but let's just leave it, right? It's, you know, we'll be a laughing stock. Let her keep them, lest we become a laughing stock. After all, I sent her the kid, but you did not buy it. Well, I did what I could with my part. But then Tamar then...
He's more concerned about his reputation than what he's carrying. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much. So what are people going to think of us? We don't do laugh at us rather than to do the right thing. But then when Tamar appears and identifies herself, how can she prove her story?
The signet ring.
Well, I skipped a step. She conceives a child. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's obvious she's...
He's ready to judge her.
Oh, yeah, he's ready to condemn her, right? For her immorality. You have played the harlot and brought this child by harlotry. Oh. So, can we add hypocrisy? To the list? Here he is being a giant hypocrite here. He's the father of this child. He's the one that went into her, unknowing that it was her, and conceived this child with her, and that's when she produces the signet ring and makes it clear that you are the one who's done it. So, how does Judah react to that, though?
He says she was more righteous than him.
She is more righteous than I, verse 26, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Selah, right? He recognized it. He did not have relations with her again. So, maybe that's a tiny form of repentance, maybe. It's at least an admission that he's done wrong, right? He should have done something other than what he did do. And even though what she did wasn't necessarily honorable, but what he did wasn't honorable either. And he can even
she was not a Jew.
Right.
Yeah.
She was a God-fearing person.
Right. Exactly. She was complete, you know, alien to God's ways. This tradition, this practice of the brother bringing the child seemed to be a cultural thing that understood, that she would have understood. But even Judah recognized that this Canaanite pagan woman had more righteousness in her heart than he did. Yes, sir.
And that's just what Tamar apparently knew something about his character.
Okay.
That he would even, I mean, because she planned this ahead. He didn't have to. He didn't have to fall in this
right,
trap.
Right, yeah.
So there was something she knew about him.
Right.
That he would fall for.
Yeah. This whole business of taking advantage of a simple prostitute that was totally consistent with something he would do. And I think is a testament to just how corrupted by the world around him Judah had become, right? The Canaanites did this all the time. This is how they worship a temple prostitute, right?
Temple.
Going into a prostitute, that was part of their fertility rites and all that, you know, this is part of their religion. And Judah was just kind of falling right in with that, not trying to be distinct from the world, not trying to follow God's teaching, God's plan, but he just blended in with all the other wicked, worldly, pagan people around him. Not a whole lot of good you can say. Now, she and Judah had twins out of this relationship, right? And one of the twins, what do we know about him later in his life?
He becomes an ally of Christ.
That's right. Judah, for reasons I hope we're about to see, Judah is one of the 12 through whom all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Yeah, he was the fourth of Leah's sons. He was one that the ultimate promise, the promise of the Messiah, would come. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The rule was to be with his tribe. And yet, this is the kind of person he was. This is the kind of character he was. And even the child was born out of this kind of relationship, not some sort of very pure bloodline necessarily, but it's a very unseemly sort of story here. But that's who Judah was, and it tells us something about who he was. So pretty wicked, pretty sinful. Almost there, I tried to go through the list, almost everything that we've talked about in the book of Genesis, from Cain killing Abel, you know, family strife, lying, deception, immorality, worldliness, hatred, murder, all the things that we've been going through and seeing as sinful behaviors in these characters that we should try to avoid, they're all wrapped up in Judah. Then we get to the story we want to look at in chapters 42 through 43, and we don't have time to read all of this. It's mainly the conclusion that we want to get to. But before we get to the story, we've noticed before, right? Is Genesis a story of a lot of words, or is it a very concise, I'm just telling you what you need to know kind of revelation? Yeah. But so many of us, you can go back to early stories, Cain and Abel, you know, the whole, you know,
creation.
Just a few words, creation, a handful of verses. And of course, the scope of the story is narrowed from the history of the universe to the history of God, you know, post-flood people to the history of the family of Abraham. And now we're getting down to three long chapters about Judah and his brothers reuniting with Joseph in Egypt. And by the time we get to chapter 44, the little speech, the statement that Judah makes, which is almost half a chapter long, right? It's one of the longest soliloquies that you have in the book of Genesis. Maybe the longest. I think that the story of the servant that Abraham sends to find a wife, he has more of a speaking role. But as far as dialogue, this plea that he makes in chapter 44 is, you know, comparative to the rest of the text, it's a lot of text being devoted to this story, and I think there's significance to that, given what he has to say. So let's quickly walk through the scenario that we're looking at, right? The time of famine had come, the famine was severe, the famine that Joseph had foretold, right, through the dreams that God had given to Pharaoh. 7 years of plenty had ended, the 7 years of famine had begun, and it reached even into the land of Canaan, and they hear, right, that there was grain down in Egypt. So they, Jacob decides to send the 10 brothers to buy grain, but who did he not want to go with him? Verse 4 of chapter 42.
Benjamin.
But not Benjamin. Okay, I can't risk Benjamin. The rest of you can go. But he's my favorite now, and I lost his brother before, and I cannot risk losing him again.
That's not going to cause any jealousy.
No, that's not going to cause any sort of problem later on. Anyway. So the brothers come, as we see, and they're here to buy grain from the Egyptian. Right? Joseph recognized them immediately. Right? But what does he do to himself? Does he disguise himself? Of course, we've already talked about he probably didn't look anything like, you know, he's dressed up now as an Egyptian. They would have trouble recognizing him anyway. And he's deliberately being harsh to them. Joseph recognized him, but they did not recognize him. And verse 9 says he remembered the dreams that he had about them, right? So it's like it's starting to come to pass, just the way that he thought.
Yes. Yeah, that when I was looking at it, I think this is where we talk about providence.
Yes.
He probably had not forgotten,
right?
But still, he had those dreams earlier on.
Right.
When he saw them, then it was like, okay,
it clicks now.
Now I see what God's
right.
been doing down
right.
in this.
So. I mean, they literally bow down to the ground, verse 6, right? They're doing exactly what the dream showed that he would do. And it's all coming clear to him now, right? But, yes, sir.
I hate to back up.
Okay.
No, please. But even when there was an appeal to Jacob, mm-hmm. to let them take Benjamin mm-hmm. to Egypt.
Yes.
There's an interesting difference in the offer of Reuben mm-hmm. and the offer of Judah.
Yes.
Reuben said, if I don't bring him back, you kill my two sons.
That's right. But Judah says...
Judah says, if I don't bring him back, hold me responsible.
I myself.
Which shows a superior character.
Yes, very much. Well, you're not backing up, you're actually getting ahead. But yes, that's an important difference, right? Let's get through the story here, and we'll get to that. The first visit, right? Joseph basically treats them harshly, accuses them of being spies, and kind of interrogates them, wants them to sort of tell some of their story, right? They have to kind of explain themselves. Is that we're 12 brothers, right? We all live in the land of Canaan. We're all son of the same man. The youngest is with our father, and one is no more. Okay, so that's what is that telling Joseph about Benjamin, perhaps?
Still alive.
He's still alive, not yeah. here. But the claim is that he's probably still alive. So what does he do? What does he arrange here to kind of make sure that he can find out whether Benjamin's really alive? What does he command them to do?
Everybody needs to show up.
Okay, yeah. Sure. And as a pledge, who do you have to leave behind? One of the brothers, right? So he puts them all in prison for 3 days. They're going to think about this, right? And he's basically accusing them of lying. You're really spies, and I don't believe your story here. So he puts them in prison, and then he tells them to go back. Bring your youngest brother to me, verse 20, so your words may be verified and you will not die. And Simeon is the one they leave behind. But as we pointed out in our last class, what do they discuss among themselves here in verse 21 and 22? That Joseph hears and understands that they don't realize.
Reuben, the oldest, says,
"Yeah,
you didn't I tell you not to stand against the boy?"
Right. Yeah.
He's not in it.
And to some extent, yeah, he did. Others, he did other things against the boy too.
He wouldn't listen.
Right. You wouldn't listen
to
me.
Have to give an account.
And you wouldn't listen to the boy, right? Yeah. We saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us. That gives us insight to what happened in the pit, right? Joseph wasn't just quietly going. He was begging his brothers, you know, to have mercy on him. Yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. So there's a consciousness of guilt that they're associating with what's happening to them now, between the famine and being put in prison and now put in this bind with the harsh Egyptian, that this is a result of what they had done in the past. And Joseph hears this, so maybe he's starting to conclude that there is some potential for repentance in their hearts here. So he sends them back with grain, but what does he do to their bags? He puts what else
money
in them?
The money.
Puts the money that they paid for the grain back into their sacks, and they discover that when they're on the way, and what do they decide to do? Well, they don't do anything with it, right? Their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to each other, what that God has done to us. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that would be a barrier to them doing what?
Going back.
because if somehow, some kind of mix-up, this wasn't their intent, but he didn't get the money. We left town with his grain, we didn't pay him for it, and he's already suspicious of us being spies. Is it going to be easy for them to just walk back in there and say, here we are, and here's our brother Benjamin, and you know, it's not. And they explain all this to Jacob when they get back, and what does he declare? That they explain the situation. If you want Simeon back, we can't go back there unless we have Benjamin. And what does Jacob conclude at the end of chapter 42? Look at the last verse. My son, that's talking about Benjamin, shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. So he absolutely refuses to let them go through with his plan. We're just going to stick it out. We can write Simeon off, okay? He's Simeon. He's already out of trouble. He already caused grief for Jacob earlier along with Reuben. But then time passes, right? Chapter 43. Another year goes by. They don't realize necessarily. This is going to be a 7-year event they're looking at. So this is now the second year of the famine being severe, and it gets so bad that they got to think about go back and get some grain. So, and it's Jacob's idea, right? The father can go back and buy us a little food. Okay, we just need a little to see if you can get some more. So, what did Judah remind him of?
He solemnly warned us, don't come back.
Yeah,
we got his brother.
This is not going to happen unless we bring Benjamin with us. Okay, this is part of the deal. He's treated him harshly, put him in prison. He was very, very clear about this. Why did you treat me so badly by telling the man you had a brother? You know, why are you giving all this personal information out to this guy? It's like, he wanted to know, right? He's quizzing us about all this. They can't figure out why he wants to know all this. I had to tell him the truth. Are they being honest with the man in Egypt? Are they telling him, laying everything out? They have been. which may be turning the corner a little bit for them here, given how much they've deceived and lied about things in the past. Perhaps because of their desperate situation, they're willing to be more truthful. So this is where, as Sewell said, this is where Reuben, is this the verse? This is where Judah says, right? I think it was, it was Reuben, and when they first got back, at the end of chapter 42, Reuben says, "You may put my two sons to death if I don't bring them back." Mm-hmm. You know, he's really put his boys on the line. You can let them take them, as if that would somehow satisfy the loss of Benjamin. But now, time passes, they're desperate again, they're out of food again, they need to go back again, and it's Judah who steps up to say, "Send the lad with me," verse 8, "and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever." So he's putting it a little more in line, elevating a little bit more. "I am personally going to be the one responsible." And that seems to persuade him. They prepare this gift of some goods that you really only get in Canaan that Egypt doesn't really have. And he agrees to send him back and ask God's blessing upon them as they go.
Can I make a quick point?
Yes, ma'am.
When Israel sends them back down there,
mm-hmm.
he said he sent the best fruit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So.
Again, they're trying to persuade the difficult Egyptian man who seems mm-hmm. to have it out for these boys. Because again, they haven't addressed the money was in our bag problem. Okay, mm-hmm. So maybe sending a gift will help smooth things over. It's going to be challenging enough, even with Benjamin, mm-hmm. to explain what happened the last time and to beg for some more food to be brought. And indeed that's on their mind when they get back and he sees Benjamin is there. He asks him to slay an animal, we're going to have a feast. And they were afraid to come into his house, so they're not in the marketplace now. They're going into Joseph the Egyptian's house, and he said, "Is it because of the money that we returned in our sack the first time that we were being brought in that he may seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for slaves?" So they're very worried about this. Do they try to lie or deceive, or do they just lay it out on the line about what happened?
They
tell the truth, exactly what happened. And he said, "Be at ease, be not afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given your treasure and your sacks. I had your money." So he brings us this. So everything seems to be going fine. And now they're having this feast in the house. And what is happening during the feast with regard to Benjamin?
He's giving more to eat than any of them.
That's right. They ate separately, as was the Egyptian custom. But he comes out from his own table, Joseph does, and brings portions to Benjamin, to all of his brothers, but five times more to Benjamin than to the others. And I think we mentioned last time, they're arranged in order of age, right? Firstborn to his birthright, youngest to his youth, and they were astonished that the Egyptians would understand that birth order, that sequence. You know, an amazing sort of thing to it. It builds in again into the divination sort of facade that Joseph is trying to create and messing with their mind. Now that Benjamin's there, who is his focus on? So what does he ask about, verse 27? He wants to know about Dad. He wants to know Dad and Pop. How is he? Is he all right? That seems to be the next thing that he's concerned about. So now, in verse chapter 44, he sends him back.
Well, they bow again.
What's that?
They're still bowing.
Yes, the bowing is still going on. Paying homage there. Still very much trying to curry favor with this man. So now he's doing much the same thing. Give them the food, as much as they can carry. Put the money back in their sack. And now take my special cup, right? That silver cup that he drinks from, and put it in whose sack?
Benjamin.
And he sends them on their way. Okay. Now this time, instead of letting them discover on their own what had happened, what does Joseph, who does he send? What instructions does he send to his men? His steward. Go follow them. Mm-hmm. And then do what? Basically, follow. So they know that he's planted the cup on mm-hmm. them. So let them go for a little while. And go out there and catch him. And say, "Is this not the one from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed uses for divination, you have done wrong in doing that. So go intercept him. You know, don't let him get all the way home. But catch him in the act here. What purpose might this serve? Maybe. In Joseph's mind. What would he be most concerned about? And you kind of see this in the negotiation, right? Because they go out there and they capture him red-handed, and of course the brothers are like, we haven't done anything, right? You know, why speak these words? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. And in fact, have they done it? They are telling the truth, absolutely. It's, and they propose, right? Verse 9, the money which we found, we brought back. How would we steal from your house? You know, we're not, you know, thieves here. With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves. This is what Joseph and the brother, or Judah and the brothers, are saying to the servant. Yes, ma'am.
I think there, I think with Joseph, I think he's probably thinking that, are they going to protect Benjamin?
Yes.
Or are they going to
throw him to the wolves? Right, right. I think that's been a concern, absolutely. The fact that they brought Benjamin back the first time maybe helps convince him that Benjamin's at least still alive. I think Joseph probably wants to protect Benjamin, because that's who he's really after, right? Because, you know, when they frame him like this, it's like, well, we're going to kill whoever it is. They don't know who it is. We'll kill whoever it is, and the rest of us will be your slaves. And maybe they're absolutely convinced that they haven't stolen the cup, because none of them have. But they find it, right? And bring it back, and, you know, it was in fact Benjamin, the worst one. You know, they've already pledged that they'll kill the one who has the cup, and it turns out to be Benjamin, the one that Israel, Jacob, is most concerned about, right? So they
Joseph is most concerned about, too.
Yes, at the same time, this is the one that, and that's what Joseph really
after. Joseph wants to keep him, in the first place, it's his full brother.
Yes.
And the second place, Benjamin's the only one that hadn't mistreated Joseph.
Right. And he's the one he wants to keep, right? So when they bring him back to Joseph, right, do you not know that I can practice divination? You know, I have magical powers. And Judah says, verse 16, this is important, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup is found. So this is they're changing their opening offer here. Before, they knew who it was. It's like, we'll kill the one that stole your cup, and the rest of them will be slaves. And now it's like, we'll all be your slaves, Benjamin included. So maybe Judah's trying to save Benjamin's life a little bit. And that's really what Joseph wants, because the counteroffer is, far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, Benjamin, he shall be my slave. But as far as you, go off in peace to your father. Take the food back to your father and your family. All he really wants is to keep Benjamin here under his protection. And he can keep supplying food to his family as long as it's necessary, as long as he can protect his own brother. But this, yes, ma'am.
In verse 14, mm-hmm. He points that Judah is in the first person, like, and his brothers. This is Judah and
yeah.
his brothers
mm-hmm.
all threw themselves to the ground. It's kind of the Bible kind of pulls out Judah.
Judah is definitely taking the lead and representing
the
brothers here.
And then you see him speaking who?
Mm-hmm. And the rest from verse 18 on down to the end of the chapter. This is that long speech I was telling you about. So think about this. In Judah's mind, does he know who this Egyptian is? Does this Egyptian know anything about their family history?
No.
Doesn't know anything about it at all. Okay, Joseph, it's really Joseph. He knows the whole story. But he goes through here and lays out his case, all the details, you know, about the family history, and about the father, and about the brothers, and about how one was lost, and how they're here under great duress, and how we promised, right? We cannot go down, verse 26, unless our younger brother is with us. He goes back to the story of Joseph and how he had been lost. Verse 30 says, now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will come about when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. Therefore, your servants will bring the great out of your servants. Basically, we can't go back without Benjamin. It would kill our father. That's how invested he is in the life of the servant. And then he says, for your servant, me, Judah, I became surety for the lads of my father, saying, if I do not bring him back, you may let me bear the blame for my father forever. I pledged myself. And so what does he propose to the Egyptian to to resolve the situation.
In verse 33.
Please let your servant, me, Judah, remain in an Egyptian prison to rot for the rest of my life, instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. Let me take his place. Okay. He's the guilty one. He's the one that had the cup. He's the one that deserves the punishment. He's the one that you only want to punish him and let the rest of us go free. But I can't do that. Let me take that punishment instead and let Benjamin go free so my father can be satisfied with his life. Does that remind you of anything that happens later in the Bible?
Jesus.
Isn't this exactly what Jesus does for us, right? Steps in here, he's totally innocent, but he'll take the punishment that's due to our sin so that we can be spared from the wrath of God. So I drew this chart some time ago. You can kind of think about Joseph and Jacob representing two different facets of the character of God, right? In this contrived story, Joseph here represents the wrath of God, right? The wrath of God is revealed because all unrighteousness of men, we've all sinned, there's none righteous, right? Not a single one of us can stand before God and claim to be pure and clean. We all deserve, in some measure, God's wrath, and that's only satisfied by punishment. God's perfect justice demands, you know, punishment for sin. That's the relationship that Benjamin has with Joseph in this contrived situation. And there's no way out of that, right? Joseph should even think, oh, how can we justify ourselves? There's no way. They're caught red-handed. They didn't do it, but there's no appeal, there's no legal way that they can find to get out of this bind that Benjamin's in. But at the very same time, you've got Israel back home, right? His father, who, what's his relationship with Benjamin? He loves him, right? He wants to be with him. He wants no harm to come from him. His father loves him, and as Judah says here, his life is bound up with the life of this child. Okay, he would die himself if any harm came to this child. And so you have the wrath of God on one side being directed at this Benjamin, then you have the love of God on the other side being directed at this Benjamin at the same time. So how can both facets of God's character be satisfied, resolved in a way that both sides are accomplishing? Well, in this case, it's Judah who says, let me step in, right? Let me, you know, I'm not guilty, but I'll take the wrath. I'll take the punishment so that wrath can be, so I'll be your slave for the rest of your life. So that Benjamin can go back and be with his father and be saved from that. Let me remain as the lad. I myself will be surety for him. So, this scenario brought to my mind at least the book of Romans, right? Chapter 1 about the wrath of God. Chapter 3 talking about how we're justified through the blood of Christ. How Christ was our propitiation, right? Satisfying the wrath of God, the atonement of God, so that God could be both
just
and the justifier of the one that has faith in Jesus. This is somewhat kind of a model of how that happened. Now, it's a very contrived sort of thing, and it's not perfect in a lot of different ways. But in some ways, what Judah does here is a foreshadowing of exactly what his descendants, Jesus Christ, would do for us on a much larger scale. And not just Christ. Remember, Judah's choosing to do this, right?
Right.
We talk about Joseph as a type of Christ, but all the things that happened to Joseph were, by and large, things that happened to him. He didn't have much choice in the matter. And he's perceived as a much more perfect person. Does he have this list of sins over here? No, he's the perfect, sinless Messiah that suffered, and through his suffering, salvation came to the people. Judah is much more of a model of, if we're going to follow in his steps, he was this really rotten guy. He was a sinner, and yet he learned through the consciousness of his guilt, through an understanding of how much his father loved him, of the stakes involved here, he was willing to step up by his own choice and deny himself, take up his cross, and, so that others may be saved. And that's a model for Christians, right? And where are we, perfect people? Are there anything here on the left that we've been involved with? Yeah. But can we grow out of that and come to understand the love that God has for us and the sacrifice we made for us and follow after the example of Christ? That's what we're supposed to be like. We're supposed to be Judas, right? We're pretty rotten people on our own, but if we follow the right path, we can be just as Christ-like as Christ was in our own way. And that's really what we're called to be, right, as Christians. That's the whole purpose, bringing many sons to glory. All right. Thank you for all your attention. A little bit over time there.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, David. I enjoyed
your
class. Thank you so much, David.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. David, there's a... I've had controversy with some wonderful good fathers too, about whether repentance is necessary to forgive one another.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's universal all through the scriptures. In fact, Luke 17 says, if you repent, I don't know that you can forgive completely until there's repentance.
Right.
The offense is an alienation that's brought about by a wrong attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And how can you put it together without that attitude change?
Right.
You bring it back. Like, well, that's actually what I'm going to do.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Yeah, you definitely
I haven't seen that for some reason.
All right.